I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Ukrainian election result is on hold after that country's Supreme Court said it would hear an appeal of the disputed results. That's bad news for Kremlin-backed presidential candidate Viktor Yanukovych, who had been declared the winner by Ukraine's Electoral Commission. But the news is a boost for the pro-Western opposition candidate, the other victor, Viktor Yushchenko. More than 100,000 Yushchenko supporters remain in the streets of Kiev today, protesting what observers say was massive fraud in last Sunday's vote. In Washington yesterday, Secretary of State Colin Powell called the election illegitimate.
It is still not too late for Ukrainian authorities to find a solution that respects the will of the Ukrainian people. Countries around the world are watching the actions of Ukrainian leaders.
European Union leaders have also condemned the result, but Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to recognize Yanukovych. Well, joining us on the line from Kiev is Tom Warner, correspondent for the Financial Times of London. And Tom, how big are the crowds?
I'm seeing more than 100,000, and the crowds are just huge. It's uncountable, really.
What's the police and military presence like, and do we know where they stand in all this?
The police and military presence is, I would say, limited, especially in the among the crowds. It's just absent. If anything, you're seeing a few police who are wearing the orange ribbons to show that they are supporting Yushchenko. But as for a hostile police presence, there's none. And then they've chosen a few places as their bastions. The police and the authorities are not trying to push the supporters of Yushchenko out of any places that they are holding. But one person was telling me this morning about how it was early this morning that the crowd just started chanting "Good morning" when the sun came up this morning, to sort of try and put the riot police in a friendly mood.
Now this is headed for the Supreme Court. How independent can we expect this court to be?
I think we can expect it to be fairly independent. Prior to the first round of the elections, it made a very important decision banning the Central Election Commission from setting up 41 additional polling stations in Russia, where Mr. Yushchenko was afraid that they would falsify the results. The government has even proposed having 420 polling stations in Russia. The Central Election Commission cut that down to 41, and the Supreme Court said none.
So
they are not a puppet court.
What will happen now? Will everyone wait for the court's ruling, or is there any hint of a negotiated end to this standoff?
I'm certain that they will wait. There is a suggestion by Yushchenko today that both candidates agree to not recognize the results. They would go back to a situation where they have to have a repeat vote for the second round of the elections, which means just the two leaders, Yanukovych and Yushchenko, hold a revote.
And is there any fear of violence with these massive crowds in the street?
Of course there is. There is a certain relatively small number of people being brought in from the East who are, for now, merely being shown on television, frankly. A few thousand supporters of Yanukovych. They don't look like the type to me who are going to rumble.
Tom Warner, correspondent with the Financial Times in Kiev. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin is a central player in the drama now underway in Ukraine, which was once part of the Soviet Union. Putin, meeting European leaders in the Netherlands, today called for a nonviolent end to the crisis. But his steadfast backing of Yanukovych puts him at odds with the U.S. and European leaders and rekindles Cold War tensions that once seemed a thing of the past. So who is Vladimir Putin? Robin Young spoke recently with Andrew Jack. He's the Financial Times Moscow correspondent and the author of a new book, Inside Putin's Russia.
Well, he's somebody who, if I could put it crudely, comes straight out of the KGB charm school. That's to say, an individual who kind of gives away nothing of himself, but prepares himself very well for meetings. So he's always got kind of the right word for you. Maybe he's found out a little bit about your own background, a little gentle comment whenever he meets people.
Such as?
Oh, well, for example, when a colleague of mine went to see him, actually his mother had fallen ill, but he made the trip to Moscow anyway. And Putin's first remark was to ask how the mother was, a very kind of gentle approach to kind of reaching out.
That's also a little scary when you think, in the old world of the Soviet Union, that would have been a frightening sort of, we know where your mother is and how she is.
That's right. And of course, judo was one of Putin's favorite sports. He grew up playing it. And a lot of people talk about that still today, how he's got an ability to throw people off balance a little bit by learning about them, by saying things that are a bit surprising. And you really very often come out feeling quite impressed by the man, perhaps initially because your expectations were relatively low. You know, this guy who was unknown was a KGB agent, and he always seems to find a way to give you the impression that you've given him something and perhaps he's learned something from you. Although, of course, what he then goes on to do is much more open to question.
Well, we'll talk more about that, but you mentioned the judo. Do you know more about him? I mean, in the States, people who lead the country, they have to prove that they chopped wood or that they were a Boy Scout. Do Russians know where he came from, what made him?
No, this question, who is Vladimir Putin, of course, was posed by Western journalists already 5 years ago. And the Russians have been going through a lot of that same process. Somebody who grew up and had his main professional experience in the KGB, this feared security police, is not somebody, of course, who was ever a public personality, even by the Soviet scale of experiences. And so it was a real surprise, actually, for most Russians when he sprung onto the scene in August 99, when President Boris Yeltsin at the time said, here is my new choice for prime minister.
And so has more come out? I mean,
we've certainly had a whole series of biographies and comments and interviews, a lot of them which looked as though they were specially engineered by Putin's image makers to explain a bit about his pretty rough upbringing in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, his background in sports and judo, and then his period in the security services, in which he emphasizes the glamorous foreign agent side rather than perhaps the more dominant snoop side, looking at his own citizens and keeping an eye on them.
When you say rough upbringing, do you mean poverty or?
Yes, I mean, certainly as far as we can establish the facts, and I've actually been to the apartment where he grew up in Leningrad. It was a very poor area of the city. He lived in what the Russians call a kommunalka, a communal apartment. So each family had a small room in which they all slept, and then they shared with a number of other families the bathroom, the kitchen, the toilet, very primitive. Putin said there were rats running up and down the corridors, and he always used to get involved in fights. So he was somebody who had ambitions and needed to find a way ahead. And his decision, in his own words, at age 16 to tap on the door of the KGB was a pretty pragmatic one, really, I think, to try to get out of that pretty miserable existence he'd been living in post-war Leningrad and try and succeed.
As somebody who has watched Vladimir Putin, and there's scenes where you've flown over Russia and looked down at the Chechen war and flown around Russia and seen this huge disparity between the very wealthy, the very poor. Just tell us more. That's what you've seen of the country, but I'm wondering what you've seen of the man. What does he do? Does he do anything in public? Does he like sports? Does he like a certain food? Does he have that kind of a relationship with the Russian people?
Well, as one of his close friends said to me quite significantly, Putin really is a bit of a loner, and he actually rather prefers the company of animals like horses than he does human beings. He actually has grown enormously as a public figure in the past 4 years. I've seen him in meetings with students, for example, where he's actually a very effective communicator. He speaks clearly, he looks informed, he uses humor, he can be pretty effective. But really, there's been a mystique and a growing mystique, particularly moving into his second term over the past few months. He doesn't do a lot of public things. He doesn't give many interviews.
Indeed, does he have children?
He has two girls, that's right, who are teenagers now and who were certainly studying in the German school, reflecting the fact that Putin himself worked in Eastern Germany during the 1980s.
Most Americans know that Russia is a country in transition, one trying to quell a separatist or a terrorist movement, depending on who's discussing it. What else can you tell us about Russia under Vladimir Putin? I mean, obviously, in the time that we have. What's the headline? What's the foremost observation?
I think, if you like, Putin's biggest achievement is stability or predictability. That at least was the thing that characterized his first 4 years in office after a period since the collapse of the Soviet Union 10, 15 years ago, when essentially ordinary Russians had suffered hugely. They'd been used to the very erratic behavior of Boris Yeltsin, who sometimes seemed to be drunk, sometimes unconscious, sometimes unable to control the forces around him. And Putin was able not only to preside over this period of sharp economic growth, but to reach out to the pensioners, the war veterans, the younger generation, and put in place a series of policies and to make a number of statements that did help to recreate Russia as something of a more coherent society. Result, very high popularity ratings, 60 or 70% even today.
Yeah, but you say stable, and I'm thinking, you know, suicide bombers on airplanes and in schools. It doesn't feel stable.
No, the irony is if the first term of Putin was pretty much characterized by stability or at least predictability, in the last 2 or 3 years in particular, there's been a very big growth in terror attacks. And there's been some other pretty surprising developments, attacks on big business and so on, which have started to create again a climate of unpredictability. No one really knows quite where he's driving the country.
He seems to be driving it very firmly, though. Some would say brutally firmly. I'm thinking of the Yukos company and the free press.
Yeah, if I had two words to sum up Putin, I'd call him a liberal authoritarian. He's somebody who broadly has encouraged or accepted the idea of the free market and liberal economic reforms. But on the other hand, he's certainly no great Democrat. If he does believe in a move towards democracy, it's not for now, it's for later, after this transitional period. And in the meantime, Putin seems to believe that any time you grant a little bit of free space, whether it's through the media or through business or through policy and politics, it gets usurped and dominated by vested corporate interests that are fighting against him. And so throughout this past 4 years, we've seen him, whether intentionally or somewhat by accident, but nonetheless with a result which has been a reduction in the information space, less diversity certainly in the printed media, and at the same time a parliament now that's much more compliant, a reduction in the number of checks and balances that we see in Russian society, and a clampdown particularly on big business, which started in his mentality, it seems, to become too uppity to start trying to define its own foreign policy, to defy Putin's reforms in terms of raising more taxes and following a sort of strategic vision that Putin has for a state-led form of development of the country.
When we come back, we continue our conversation with Andrew Jack and look at the relationship between Mr. Putin and President Bush. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. We continue now with Robin Young's conversation with journalist Andrew Jack of the Financial Times, who's written a new book, Inside Putin's Russia.
A few months ago, the Kremlin set up a website for children, and there are a series of multi-option responses. What do you think of the following? And then you could click to see what Putin's response was. And I have to say, one was pretty concerning. It essentially said, if two boys are fighting in the schoolyard, who would you judge? You know, should you blame the one who started it or the one who lost, both of them, because you shouldn't get involved in fights? And Putin's choice was, I'd support the one who won, because history never judges the loser. I think that was a pretty telling statement.
George Bush, go to the website, go to Vladimir Putin's website. And you say that Russians like tough leaders, and we actually are seeing this movement we hear about here, this sort of nostalgia movement for the old Soviet Union, right? Aren't there sort of restaurants or clubs where people can go and they have old Soviet memorabilia around?
Yeah, it goes to the extreme even of a nightclub in Moscow, which has been kitted out to look like a gulag prison, which is pretty extraordinary. And I think it says something about the divisions that continue in Russian society today, that Russians still haven't come to terms really with the most sinister aspects of the communist past. And if you like like the economic growth of the past 4 years has kind of recreated a sense of pride and nationalism and a resistance to what they see as a kind of failed attempt to introduce Western values during the 1990s.
Yeah. We're thinking also of Vladimir Putin being criticized for his handling of the sinking of the submarine, the Kursk, and Russians wanted somebody who could show a softer side to deal with that event. So he was criticized there as well.
Yeah, I think actually the Western criticism of Putin over the Kursk was certainly that he stayed down in his holiday home on the Black Sea coast and he didn't rush like a Western political leader would have done to the scene of the accident to try to coordinate. But of course, Putin comes from this technocratic Soviet tradition where public opinion ratings or images were much less important than the idea of getting the job done. And his argument was that if he went up there, all the admirals trying to focus on the rescue operation would rush to roll out the red carpet, meet him at the aeroplane, and distract from the job in hand.
How has Vladimir Putin's handling of Chechnya affected the way Russians view him as a leader?
Chechnya is a very sensitive point for Putin. It's one of the few areas where when journalists pose him questions, he very often loses his cool and becomes very emotional, uses slang, and defends very strongly the position he's taken. And that in itself seems to suggest that he's perhaps not quite in control of the situation as much as he would like.
Do people want him to negotiate with Chechens? Do they take his view that these are terrorists? And how do the Russians see it?
I think the problem is Putin inherited already a very difficult problem in Chechnya. In the late 90s, when I came to Russia, Chechnya was de facto independent. It was ruled over by Maskhadov, a former rebel leader who'd been elected in internationally recognized elections. But in the following 2 years, we had widespread criminality. We had no reconstruction, kidnappings that were taking place of Chechens, of Russians, and even of foreigners. And so criminal anarchy, if you like, which many Russians became totally fed up with. I mean, today they would still prefer essentially to forget about Chechnya, to ignore it, to push it to one side. And I have to say the general view is probably very supportive of an aggressive line. And on the other hand, to hope simply that it'll just go away as a problem.
Staying with the Chechen story, but as it relates to the relationship between Putin and Bush, some in this country would say that Vladimir Putin has positioned George Bush in a way that sort of has trapped George Bush into accepting Putin's view of Chechnya as a terrorist uprising as opposed to a nationalist movement.
I think Bush was an early victim, if you like, of Putin's charm. Of course, it was ultimately Bush who said that he'd looked into Putin's soul and seen somebody who could trust. In reality, I think both leaders are pretty much believers in realpolitik. Putin has said that he disagrees with Bush on a number of issues. But on the other hand, he likes the man personally in the sense that he's somebody who he believes will tell him what he's going to do and will go ahead and do it. So there's a degree of predictability to it.
But what about that personal chemistry part? Do you believe that there's this frisson between the two? I mean,
you know, I'm not sure that KGB operatives really believe in personal chemistry at a deep level. I think the reality is that they're both playing a little bit of a game, but Bush is probably a much more informal, relaxed person than Putin can be. He always looks a little bit awkward when he's dressed casually, you know, when he walked around the ranch in Texas and so on. He's playing a game. But of course, both sides are. And the fact is that when oil supplies matter very much to the US and oil prices, and when Putin is willing to at least pay lip service to offer support on the fight against terror, I think the Bush administration has been quite willing to turn a blind eye to a lot of the internal abuses within Russia.
Mm. President Bush was just reelected. Tony Blair is eyeing the horizon warily. Vladimir Putin was also reelected. When you look at the men on the chessboard right now, who do you think is going to have the longest staying power?
I think Putin himself is clearly going to be around for at least until 2008, his current term. And it's hard to imagine that when that term comes up, he's going to disappear entirely from the political scene.
He's so young.
He's very young. That's right. He's only in his mid-50s now. And clearly in just 3 or 4 years' time, he's way younger than most of the previous Russian and Soviet leaders, for example, in looking towards retirement. He's also incredibly fit. That said, it's hard to imagine Putin becoming perhaps an international political figure, which means his fate and his future is going to be most definitely linked to Russia itself and that area around Russia of the former Soviet states.
Mm. Andrew Jack, his book is called Inside Putin's Russia, Can There Be Reform Without Democracy? Thank you.
Thank you.
Financial Times Moscow correspondent Andrew Jack speaking there with Robin Young. Now to Iraq, where U.S. Marines and Iraqi soldiers are continuing their sweep of Fallujah. They're still encountering small groups of insurgents, but most of the work now is assessing the extensive damage to the city. The Marines have found several large caches of weapons and explosives, and today the New York Times reports the discovery of a mosque packed with bombs, guns, and grenade launchers. It was the base of a key insurgent leader, Abdullah Janabi. Janabi, who's thought to have fled Fallujah, had been offering safe haven for any foreigner willing to take up arms against the Americans. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll profile one of these foreigners, a man who snuck into Iraq to find a sophisticated and well-run insurgent operation. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is television network news doomed? Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw are going. Peter Jennings is hanging on, but ABC's Nightline program looks threatened. Nightline was launched 25 years ago this month in the early days of the Iran hostage crisis.
This is a message of the students in the American Embassy of Tehran.
The hostage crisis lasted 444 days. Nightline was there every night in the then unheard of 11:30 time slot. But today, that's important ratings real estate, and Nightline is being trounced by late-night comedy. ABC wants changes. The show's executive producer just resigned in protest, and it's anyone's guess what will happen to host Ted Koppel when his contract expires next year. Here and Now's Robin Young recently spoke with Koppel about Nightline now and back then, back in 1979 when news wasn't 24/7.
Americans were obsessed with this story. They couldn't get enough of it. And after a few days, some smart producer came up with the idea of giving them the title America Held Hostage, which was an excessive title when it was first created. Over a period of weeks and months, it turned out to be prophetic because in many respects, America was held hostage by the 52 men and women who were being held in Tehran at the embassy.
I do remember back then America sitting on the edge of its seat, tuning in every night. And if that kind of a program was launched today, same title, same situation, same sort of tension every night, do you think that there would have been screaming on either the left or the right that it was somehow that it somehow had some agenda?
Oh, sure, but because of the 24/7 cable networks now, that I don't think it would have the same impact today that it did back then. To get more directly to your question, whether it would be perceived as politicizing, of course it would. Everything that we cover these days is perceived to have a political impact of one kind or another. Some months ago, this was just after Nightline had done The Fallen. You may recall I read the names of 721 American men and women who had by then already been killed in Iraq, and we just showed the photographs, and I read the names. And that was perceived by the Bush White House as being a political act that was unfriendly to the administration. At one of these Washington dinners, The president's chief political advisor, Karl Rove, happened to be sitting next to the president of ABC News, David Weston. And they were having a discussion, and Karl Rove was complaining that he thought this had been a political act. And David said to him, what if exactly the same program had appeared on Fox? Would you still have perceived it as being unfriendly to the administration? He said, no, of course not. So, I mean, it was a strange admission for him to make. There was just this assumption, and I don't want to generalize it to ABC, but there was just this assumption that if it appeared on Nightline, it had to be unfriendly to the administration. Had the same program appeared on Fox, it would have been perceived as friendly.
In fact, it wasn't carried. The program The Fallen wasn't carried by the conservative Sinclair Broadcasting Company, the same station group that wanted to air the anti-Kerry documentary prior to the election. They said at the time they made their decision that your program appeared to be motivated by a political agenda designed to undermine the efforts of the United States in Iraq. What was the purpose of the program?
It was very simple. The purpose of the program was to remind people of the cost of war. With the notable exception of the men and women around the country who have family members or very close friends who are over in Iraq fighting this war, the rest of us are paying little or no price. And I am afraid I am not a great fan of the fastidiousness of most television networks about not showing the dead, not showing the wounded. I think we have an obligation to show the dead and the wounded. I think we have an obligation to remind people that war is a terrible thing. That's not a political statement about whether this war is the right war or the wrong war. It's simply a statement that says you can't fight a war without paying a high price.
Well, in fact, many ABC affiliates didn't air the film Saving Private Ryan. Some said it was because of, you know, the graphic violence, but some people believe the real reason is that, as you've been saying, it did show what war is really like, and some people don't want people to see that.
Actually, most of the, I think there were about 65 affiliates who didn't carry it, and at least the reason they gave was their uncertainty over whether they would be fined by the FCC for all the profanity that is used in that movie. And the FCC, curiously enough, was approached beforehand and said, well, would you or wouldn't you? And they gave no response.
Well, you have said that the conservative media, including Fox and its radio talk show hosts, have redefined the mainstream media as liberal. How did they do that? And should the mainstream media have gone more on the defense about that sooner?
I don't think you can go. I mean, the best thing you can do is try to write clean copy. The best you can do is try to play the stories down the middle as best you can. All I can say is I, for many years, for 40-some-odd years, have done the best I can to cover stories as factually and as objectively as I can. And if now suddenly people are going to start looking at what I do and say, because I don't believe that factual or objective reporting includes waving the flag in times of national crisis, that somehow makes me ideologically suspect, well, then so be it.
I wonder, do you think of doing anything to react to the fact that numbers of Americans have gone over to the Fox network? It tripled its ratings on election night. There are studies that show that people who watch Fox News exclusively are misinformed on issues from weapons of mass destruction to John Kerry's war record. I know, in addition to wanting to tell great stories, I would assume you want to inform people. Do you think of ways to reach out to what seems to be a divided America?
Politically, this country is like a pendulum, that it tends to swing a little bit too far to the right, as it did, for example, during the McCarthy years in the early 50s, and then it swings a little bit too far to the left, as it did during the late 1960s, and, you know, eventually it passes through the center again, and then the pendulum starts to swing off in the opposite direction. The one thing you can always count on in this country is that nothing remains stationary. Change will always come, and I think if journalists keep on doing the best they can to report the stories as cleanly, factually, and objectively as they can, eventually people will rediscover that.
Ted Koppel, last question, closing in on 25 years at Nightline. Who's on your list? Who could be left on your list of people you'd want to interview?
Oh, there's always a new batch. You know, that's the great thing. I mean, there aren't many people left on the original list. Let me put it that way. If they haven't been interviewed, they've died. So either way, I'm not going to get to them again.
Ted Koppel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, NBC and CBS are also in a state of flux. After 21 years anchoring NBC's nightly news, Tom Brokaw is retiring. His last broadcast is December 1st. And this week, longtime CBS anchor Dan Rather announced his departure 2 months after he admitted mistakes were made in a CBS report that raised questions about President Bush's service in the National Guard. Last week, before Rather made his announcement, CBS veteran commentator Andy Rooney was in Boston to talk to students at Tufts University. I asked him what he thought of the CBS mistake of using suspect documents.
I don't know how the mistake happened. I think, actually, like any news organization, they were anxious to get the story on. It was a big story, fairly big, to tell you the truth. I'm not even sure about the story itself. There are very few people I know who were subject to the draft who wouldn't have taken some help from their father if they could have gotten it. If my father had offered to help me stay out of the Army when I'm in 1942, I would have gladly taken his help. Yeah. And I think probably George W. Bush took that help from his father, and I don't condemn him for that.
So you would have, you would have taken a different tact on the story.
Well, I just didn't think it was that big for that reason.
Which is sort of the Andy Rooney way. You do seem to take maybe a slightly different take on a story than many of your colleagues.
Well, I take the right take, and everybody else takes the wrong take.
Well, let's ask you about another story. CBS recently fired the news producer who interrupted primetime programming, the very popular CSI New York, to announce the death of Yasser Arafat. After she was fired, CBS released a statement saying the interruption was a mistake. Your thoughts?
I think it was a mistake of the executives to fire her. I think she was a very serious news person, and she certainly did it with the best intention. She thought it was the right thing to do, and they thought it was the wrong thing to do because it involved money. But I object strenuously to her having been fired. I mean, the only thing that matters anymore in any kind of news is money. It's just it's a shame. We should have found some way in this country to provide, I mean, the most important thing to a democracy is that we have an informed electorate. And the only way they're going to be informed is through the news they get. They should all, television in particular, should be, I think, forced to provide news without commercials in exchange for the license they have to make millions of dollars on their entertainment broadcast.
Mm. I have to ask you here.
I assume this isn't heard in many places, so I can say that without getting fired myself.
Why do you assume this isn't heard in many places? I mean, we're on the radar, Andy. Mm. Andy Rooney, what do you think about? We were just talking to Ted Koppel about the sense that the mainstream media, CBS, ABC, NBC, seem to have been defined of late by what used to be the fringe media, Fox News. For instance, they've been painted as the liberal media and didn't launch an offense or a defense sooner.
Well, in my lexicon, being liberal never needed to be defended. It has gotten to be opprobrious only recently and only in the eyes of conservatives. The phrase liberal to me is not a dirty word.
Well, you're in town to speak to students. What's the one thing you want to impart to them, you know, journalists just starting out?
I hope to tell them how important I think facing the facts of life are. I mean, so many Americans refuse to face obvious truths about our life in the United States, and it bothers me a lot. Religion bothers me a lot. The word faith has been appropriated. I mean, faith really is belief without substantiation. And it's strange that faith has gotten to be such a big word, because that doesn't make it sound very nice.
Does anyone ever tell you what to say?
No, I have been remarkably free from interference. The producer of 60 Minutes for years, Don Hewitt, he would said a couple of times to me, he said, you know, this is going to be trouble for you. He said, I'm not saying you can't do it, but just understand you're going to get in trouble. And I said, I know that, but I'll do it anyway.
Andy Rooney, thank you so much.
Okay.
Robin Young talking there with CBS's Andy Rooney. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. We leave you today with this Thanksgiving remembrance from Robin Young.
Some listeners might remember a pilgrimage we made to Vermont 3 years ago to see the annual migration of the snow geese with my uncle Lachlan McLachlan Field, who, like the geese, was slowly leaving us. He'd just begun a bout with Alzheimer's. Well, I'm sorry to report that my uncle died 2 weeks ago. But I'm glad to be able to share again a story of a trip I'm so thankful I took. The snow geese, thousands of them, touch down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcards. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hey, yo!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLachlan Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen you. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
She's a pro. What, you think someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
Ah, so, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south, so they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe, but no guarantee this time they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they aren't going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes and by the thousands. I saw one time I walked out in the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Yeah. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field length.
Really?
Yeah. So I got this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down, down, down. Never seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
There's a lot of times the geese get out in there, see?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's also...
Name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's goose.
Huh? Yeah.
Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is. The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Around!
Yeah.
Something.
Here they come.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know. I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
But I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see. And tree height. Far south as you see.
Okay. We're getting frozen.
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah. I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up and took off. I mean, you know.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
When you want to get something to eat?
You want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
Uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field died 2 weeks ago at home in Vermont at the age of 91 after a bout with Alzheimer's. In the end, I'm not sure how much he remembered of our trip to see the snow geese. I hope I never forget.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer is Lindsay Crudell. Our interns are Jennifer Miller and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Alan Cockle. Happy Thanksgiving, and join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.